just anybody.
Help!
You know I need someone.
Help!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. This is Bill Arnold, and across the studio, head of the I Think George is Cool Committee, George Fraser. Hello, George.
Billy, how are you?
I am exhausted because today was the City of Lakes Marathon, and I was one of 20,000 people that ran. But I quit after two blocks.
Seriously.
You know, they talk about the hitting the wall. Runners talk about hitting the wall. I hit it at block one. Block two, I hit a table that had the donuts on it. And that angered a lot of people, and I thought I should probably go home. I had the wrong footwear, too. I had my wingtips on. And it turns out that is the wrong pair of shoes to wear to run a marathon. But at 4 a.m. when you're getting ready, it's dark.
Yeah.
You know, and you think you're putting on tennies, and you've got on the wingtips and black socks and shorts. So it was not, I didn't even look good. But I trained for it. You know, yesterday was my, well, let's see, Thursday was my last hard day of training. I ran around my block 33 times. I know that sounds impressive, but I live in a cul-de-sac. So I got more dizzy, more dizzy than anything. But welcome to Real Recovery. George, tell the listeners about our show.
Well, I'm glad that you made the effort today, Bill. I think we're all real proud of you.
Thank you. I didn't carb load correctly. You know, carb loading is everything.
Is it really? Yeah.
From what I understand.
How did you do it, then?
I had four additional pillows of shredded wheat. That's all I had for carb loading. It's not enough. I think that's why I hit the wall at block one.
Well, next year, you know, you know that.
I do know that. I'm going to take notes and write it in a journal, and then I'll be able to prepare better next year.
Well, we're always talking about on Real Recovery that we want to have an active recovery. So this is a big part of that. And I know a lot of people that ran today in the Twin Cities Marathon. Part of what we want to do on this show is look at that all our sinful behavior, our addictions, our overeating, our anger, we're all missing the mark. We're sinning against God. So the solution isn't to stop the behavior. It is to start a relationship with the living God. And that's what Real Recovery is all about. And every week we do one of the 12 steps. We talk about it because what we want to do is have an active, engaged program. It's not about avoidance of behavior, Bill. We don't want to put a Band-Aid on the wound. We want to go to the source. And the only healing power that we can really have is through Jesus Christ. So that's what this show is about. If you're a Christian, you are in recovery. Your behavior should have changed from what you used to be like. And we're interested in hearing about how are you walking out your faith. We work out our salvation with fear and trembling. How do you do it? We all agree, as you say, Bill Arnold, to vote for Jesus. But how do you live for him on a daily basis? How do you pick up your cross and deny yourself daily? That's what we want to talk about.
Oftentimes people under stress and when they start to reach for whatever addiction they suffer from, they're not willing to put the important in front of the urgent. And I think one of the things we always have to remind each other, George, is to always put the important before the urgent.
Okay.
I don't know what that means exactly.
I'm telling you, I'm impressed. I'm looking at who said it.
Well, I get it. I'm going to stand by my statement as long as there's no follow-up questions. So if you don't ask me any further questions.
What is the difference between importance and urgent?
Well, okay. When it comes to fleshly desire and satisfying something that you want, you're gonna go for the urgent. You're gonna grab the drink or try the drug or eat the donut. The cookie and the donut.
I think it's really mean of you to bring up donuts. You know
it's
what
right.
That does? That triggers an emotional response in me.
But if we put the important before the urgent, I think we can always make the right decision.
What is the important?
The important is obedience to Christ. The importance is not satisfying the flesh.
Okay.
I didn't say that well, but you know what I'm trying to say, don't you?
For me, the way I would say it,
interpret it, George Fraser.
And I wouldn't, and I'm not wearing wingtips with black socks. Actually, it works for you, Bill. It really actually does.
You're trying to get back at me. Such a small-minded man.
Absolutely. I've accepted that years ago. What I would say on this is I want what I want when I want it. I want it right now, and usually lots of it. And what I want to do is subjugate, that's a big word for me, subjugate my emotional response to a well-thought-out, committed response that I want to follow what Jesus wants for me, not what I want for me. And you really tied that into step 11 unknowingly, because I know you don't know that.
Of course I don't.
But step 11 is we thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him. We understand him to be Jesus Christ, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Not our will for him. This isn't a magic genie situation where I get three wishes. It's what his will is for me. And I think a lot of us, when we get into our Christian walk, we're avoiding a negative behavior or consequence, i.e. an addiction or a behavior we don't like. And then Jesus becomes our servant rather than us serving him. I've met a lot of people that I've worked with, Bill, in recovery, as have you, who do not make it. And they will tell us that the program didn't work for them and God didn't work for them. And I always try to tell them, no, you're supposed to work for God. You got it backwards. And that's a tall order for us, isn't it?
You have become the oracle of inspiration tonight.
Too much coffee is probably what that is.
Whatever. So, George,
but I'm working on this step, seriously.
Yeah.
Can I add that a little bit?
No, please.
I'm going to Psalm 46:10 where it says, "Be still and know that I'm God." When I start in the morning, and I've gotten better at this, my quiet time with God, sought through prayer and meditation, not prayer and medication where I medicate myself with false gods of exercise, sugar, smoking, gambling, you know, things to excite me. Getting still is hard for me. And listening for God's small voice is hard for me, and it comes through people. Bill, a week ago Friday, we played golf with three other guys. I was in a foursome, and little did we know that night that one of the guys' son would fall to his death, his only son, a 32-year-old guy. And God knew that before we teed off, but we didn't know that, and we found out afterwards, and we had the same God before, during, and after, but gosh, We don't know a lot of things, and I need to get still and go, okay, you know, he gives, he takes, praise God. And my buddy really suited up and showed up at his son's funeral, and he got to talk about how he looks forward to seeing his son again.
Mm.
And the only way you can do that, Bill, is if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, because by one name are we saved.
Yep, and there's the only way to have hope.
And that's what it is. It is hope,
no matter
what the circumstances.
Yeah.
You nailed it.
Without hope, you perish. One of the verses that really ties into step 11 for me, George, and I've memorized it in Greek and Hebrew, but just
can you do it in English for me?
Yeah, I'm gonna
thank you.
I'm gonna dumb it down for you.
I know Alex would get it, but
yeah, he'd get it. But it's from Luke 6, verse 45. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart.
Okay.
For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. And to me, that really ties into step 11, which is prayer and meditation. If you're storing up good things in your heart or evil things in your heart, that's what's going to come out.
It's a good measure.
Where the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. So really, the big question is what's in your tank? What's in the tank called the heart?
We need to measure our words, don't we?
We really do.
I think for me, it shows me how messed up my heart is, and that there's a lot of things I want to say that I don't. That's progress for me. But on the flip side, if I had such a great heart, I wouldn't think in the first place, right?
I think this verse exactly. What you just said is exactly this verse.
And we are making some progress there. But what I really want to do is change my heart, and I can't do that. But God can and will if we let him.
Right.
And that's a great verse there, Bill.
Let me just reread the first part of the verse, because I think it's right on to what you were saying. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart.
Who's a good man? Is there any?
Well, George, what am I, the answer guy?
Well, apparently not. Tell another joke. No, didn't Jesus say, no one is good except the Father?
Right.
Okay, sorry. No, he's mad.
I'm not mad. If you're a Bible professor, please call in and straighten us out. We'd like to know what the answer is. There's wisdom, and a good man will bring good things out of the good stored up in his heart.
Okay.
So in other words, if we're putting God's word in our heart, storing scripture memory in our hearts and minds, hopefully that comes out of what's stored up in our heart. And if we're just sowing evil, a good chances are that the evil will come out. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. That's what the verse says, George.
I have hidden thy word in my heart, so I will not sin against thee. I want to change my heart. And we talk about an active recovery, Bill, spending time in the word. This is work. You know, we don't just go, okay, I'm going to change, and then it happens. You have to do the work. A farmer once told me, and you know, I live out, you know, side of the city, that God...
You can say trailer park, George.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
It doesn't bother me.
You probably offended 90% of our audience, but I do. It's a nice one, though. And he told me, you know, God provides the sun, the soil, the seed, the rain, but you have to do the work. You have to, you know, weed the crops, and you have to harvest it. So we have to do some work here. And spending time in the Word is where it starts for me.
All right. We're going to go to break in just a second here, but I want to look at Psalm 19:14.
Okay.
And George, that says, may these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. It doesn't say, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my sin manager. He's our rock and redeemer.
Yes, sir.
He's our deliverer.
Correct. Feel like Ed McMahon over here. We're going to do an Alpo commercial next. Yeah,
we might.
You are right. I got to get the focus off of me because it's about him.
Oh, the focus has got to get off ourselves. So when we come back, we're going to bring on our guests, Steve and Diane. They have a wonderful ministry.
I'm looking forward to this, Bill.
I can't wait. They've got powerful stories. You are listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser on Faith Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold with George Fraser, who leads a very interesting life in his own mind. We are on KTIS 900 AM here in the Twin Cities. If you're listening in Madison, Wisconsin tonight, you'd be on WNWC 1190 AM. Welcome to the show.
All our friends in Madtown, welcome
in
to the show.
In Madtown, yep. Waterloo, Iowa would be KNWS 1090. We hope you're listening, and if you have any calls for us, feel free to give us a call. We don't take calls, but... we'd love to see the phones ring and light up once.
Be nice, Bill.
That'd be nice. Be nice. But without further ado, I think ado is a French word, George. I don't know what it means. A lot of people use it. I don't think they know what it means when they say further ado.
Ado.
Yeah, ado. We'd like to bring onto our program our guests tonight, Steve and Diane C. Steve and Diane, welcome to the show.
Hi.
You guys
Thanks
are still.
Having-
you're still there.
Yes, we are.
Tempted to hang up, weren't you? We're glad you didn't.
I'll never tell.
Well, just tell us about your day, because I think last time we spoke, you were going to be at a women's prison this morning doing ministry. How'd that go?
Right. Actually, you know, we love it. We go to the York facility here in Nebraska the first Sunday of every month and then also the fifth Sunday. And what we've done over the years is we've been able to develop relationships with these women and introduce them, even more importantly, to a relationship with Jesus Christ. And it started out as an evangelism type of an opportunity, but really what this always seems to turn into is deeper relationships and getting in touch and being a part of the body of Christ.
Well, I know you both have very colorful stories. Is that a good way to put it? So you guys can flip a coin and decide who goes first, because I think you both have amazing stories to tell, and our listening audience can't wait to hear them.
Well, I'm getting the point right now.
Okay, you got the point. You go ahead.
let's see. Going back, I don't know how far we go back. I guess I grew up in a Christian home.
Grew
up where the gospel was believed and preached, and you know, when I was 14, I'd had enough of that and took off. And, you know, I found my way to prison. I went to Los Angeles, and I had some family down there. And, you know, shortly, I'd say by the time I was 16, 17, I was using hard narcotics on a regular basis, running the streets of L.A. And by the time I was 18, I went to prison for the first time.
And you were in the California system?
I was in the California system.
At 18. Wasn't that scary?
Yeah, you know, the L.A. County Jail's got like 10,000 inmates in any given moment. And you know, I grew up in, you know, I wasn't from L.A. I grew up in Washington State, up in the northwest, in a small town. And so to go from there to the Los Angeles County Jail, yeah, that was pretty intimidating. And,
wow. You don't get mints on your pillows at night, do you, there?
No, not a whole lot.
No, I didn't think so.
You gotta watch what you got on your pillow, that's for sure.
So you're 18, you're incarcerated. You're already doing a kind of leading a street life.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal activity in there as well?
Tons of it.
Like what?
You name it, from robbery, burglary, just anything. It was kind of what you had said earlier. I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted it right now, and I didn't care who had it, and I didn't care. You know, it was you know, all about me. And strangely enough, when it's all about me, that nothing but destruction happens in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny how that works. The more I want, the worse it gets. So, I did 2 years in the prison system there, and, I got to experience the lower custody trip. You know, they have fire camps out there where you go and you help the firefighters fight these fires, and you know, it's not a lot like being incarcerated, although it kind of is. But so I think that was maybe a slap on the wrist for me, because that was no deterrent whatsoever, because I immediately got out and started doing exactly the same thing I was doing before, and wound right back up in prison. Only the second time I went to prison, they weren't as nice to me. And I ended up finding my way to Pelican Bay, which was it's the security housing unit for California. They built it back in 1990, I think, to house the unruly and the extremely incorrigible.
But it sounds so pleasant.
It sounds like a place I'd like to play the course.
Pelican Bay.
Yeah.
You've got two championship courses.
Yeah, two, they're great courses, Bill.
Yeah. All right, so you're
at Pelican Bay. Sorry, we have ADD up here, so you're at Pelican Bay. And
yeah, I spent 2.5 years in solitary confinement there.
Ooh.
I was by that time I was a gang member, white supremacist gang, and by this time I'd been shot and stabbed and overdosed a few times, left for dead. I mean, it was a whole lot of fun, you know, and so here I was sitting in the hole for 2.5 years, and in those times I would cry out to God, because I knew who He was, but you know, it was like you get into these spots, you know, those are spots, let me tell you, and you cry out to God because I don't like these spots, and I know that there's freedom out there, and so you cry out to Him. And then, I don't know, I'd gone through this ringer a few times, or put myself through this ringer where I believe that I believe, and then as soon as I get a little bit of freedom, as soon as I get a little air under my wings, then I'm off and running.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so you voted yes for God,
but
you're just not living for Him.
Exactly. Okay. I voted yes, and in the hole, when I'm surrounded by nobody but myself.
What is that then, like? What is that like to be in solitary?
Lonely. The thing of it is we were talking last night. We have a fellowship group that gets together on Saturday nights, and I was talking about it last night and saying that, you know, God's grace carried me through that time, because I was watching guys lose their minds, literally lose their minds, and who had been there for less time than I was, but God's grace got me through that. And then, you know, as soon as I got out of the hole, I still had to spend the remainder of my sentence in prison.
Which is how many years?
I did a total of 8 out there in California.
Okay.
And I did another 3 here in Nebraska, because I wasn't done yet.
So you had 2 years in solitary?
Yeah, 2.5.
What do you think about? What goes through your head?
Didn't I just ask that?
Well, kind of, yeah, but I mean, it's like I'm just trying to imagine.
You're fixated on that, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
I think it's real important.
Okay.
You know, because you could snap real easy. Kind of like you're ready to do now.
Yeah. I got a vein on my forehead that's starting to
scare me.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, how do you keep the voices down in your head when that's going on?
Millions of push-ups.
Hmm.
I mean, seriously, that was part of the day every day. Is I would, strangely, I would make a list of things to do that day. I mean, I'm in the same room all day every day, and yet I found some comfort in knowing that these were the things that I had to do. And so I would make a list, like, okay, I'm going to make my bed. I'm going to read for so long. I'm going to work out for so long, and just, you know, then lunch would come or what, you know, whatever the case was.
Okay.
And I would knock those things off the list so that when I laid my head down on my pillow that night, because that's the other thing, is I'm not, you don't want to sleep all day because then you're up all night. And that's, you know, so I had all these things set aside for me to do that day. So when I laid my head down on my pillow that night, the list was done, you know. And then I had the last thing on my list, of course, was to make another list for tomorrow. And so, I mean, I don't know that got me through. I just have to rely and lean on the fact that God's grace carried me through, because he knows the end from the beginning, and he knew what was in store. And while I didn't, he carried me through that, because there was some stuff that had to take place.
So you needed order and structure, didn't you?
I did. I craved it.
I bet.
And
you just listed was more than George does every day.
He didn't say he watched TV, though.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay? No, that was kind of the point of the question. We believe in an active recovery, and structure works pretty well, doesn't it?
It does.
It really does. It really does. You know, and I tell guys all the time, because, you know, like I said, we're in the prisons now all the time, and I tell them that very thing. Like the habits that you start now, today, are going to be the habits that carry you through into tomorrow and then into your recovery, through your recovery. And so, even in that time, I had no real intention, I don't think, of being in recovery of any type. You know, I think I was pulling the emergency ripcord as I was falling, hoping that God would somehow, you know, come through in a pinch, and you know, really, he did. But regardless of my intentions and regardless of what would pan out, he was still there. And I think that's hope for some people, you know. It's hope for me that even when I'm not, even when my intentions aren't so pure, and even when my recovery isn't so refined or whatever, he's there.
Yep.
And he carries me and he loves me. Because, you know, like I said, I got out of the hole and I went and spent, you know, a couple of years in Folsom, a couple of years down in Lancaster, where we got to open up a brand new prison, which is always a fun ordeal. And I didn't get out of stop the gang activity until a couple months before I knew I was going to get out of prison, because I started looking at my life and thinking, you know, okay, here I've been in prison for basically most of my formative years. I did juvenile time before that. And so my adult years were all spent in prison. I had tattoos all over my arms of, like, Hitler's face and swastikas and just horrible, horrible things that I had no idea what I was going to do with in the free world. That kind of stuff is not acceptable in the free world. And so by way of, I don't know, survival or whatever the case was, I started to really look at it and think, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, I started to look at the people I was associating with and started realizing, you know, and this is from a purely secular standpoint, like, I don't want to do this. You know, this is not who I am, and this is not who I want people to think I am or know that I am. And so I started to disassociate myself, which is really hard to do when you're, like, the leader. And so, it wasn't too long before I got a knife in my back, literally, and that was enough to catapult me out of that gang lifestyle. It wasn't enough to catapult me into recovery. That wasn't going to happen for quite a while later, or until quite a while later. But it was enough to get me out of that particular part of my life that was so distasteful. I got out of prison in 1996 and immediately left California because, you know, California was the problem.
Sure. Geographic cure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I knew that if I could just get out of California, the problems would all be solved. Well, the problem really was that everywhere I went, I took my sick self with me. And so it wasn't long before, you know, I was taking things from people in New Mexico, whether that be emotionally, whether that be financial, whatever it was, physical, emotional, spiritual. I was like a big sponge for whatever you had, whether it was your joy or whether it was your money. And so that's where, you know, that's what happened in New Mexico. And then I ran from there. And I mean, I've made my way all over the United States. And it's funny because I was running so hard to try to get away from the problem. And I kept bringing it with me. And that was my disease.
That is so interesting. Steve, we're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to hear more of your story as well as Diane. And we're going to hear about the recovery side of it and the joy that you guys are having right now in Christ and sharing your hope with others. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Frazier on Faith Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
Softly now.
Welcome back, everybody, to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold and George Frazier. George is a licensed chemical dependency counselor with 29 years of sobriety under his belt. Congratulations to that, George.
29 years and 2 weeks.
Yeah. He's got a master's degree. I got nothing.
We got today.
I got nothing. I am a marathon quitter.
Yeah, there's next year, though.
I don't know if I'm going to do it. My motto is never quit. Unless it's harder than you want it to be, then quit. Anyway, we're talking to Steve and Diane, and Steve is telling his riveting story of a life of crime, ending up in prisons, and still feeling pretty angry, carrying his problems with him everywhere he goes.
Steve, I want to ask you why you were so angry, and then get into how you got into recovery. Sounds like a lot of anger was there. Is that right?
It was such, you know, I think about that passage in Ephesians chapter 2 where it says I relate to it because I was so filled with rage. It was rage. Mm-hmm. It was, I guess there was anger, but it was, there's rage there too.
Yep.
And I don't, honestly, I don't really know why it, I mean, I still haven't pinpointed like why is that? Because I look at my upbringing, which was not bad. You know, there was frustrations, but everybody has frustrations. There, you know, and I think, you know, I was adopted when I was a kid, but you know what? I was adopted, so that I mean, that's a good thing. And so I really don't know what the deal was. I kind of tend to attribute it to I like to say that puberty was the worst 20 years of my life. But I don't know. I just carried this huge chip on my shoulder. And you know, everybody else was the problem. Everywhere else was the problem. And never once could it pause, because I was always slighted and I was treated badly. And I was always, you know, as long as I didn't have to look at myself, then everything was going to be fine, because then I could just be mad at everybody else. You know, growing up basically in the prison system in California, that was a safe emotion. It was the safest emotion that I could possibly have. And so it was one that I leaned on, even more so. You know, I came in angry, so then I could be really mad all the time and then, like, express that frustration through violence and, whatever, manipulation, whatever. And so it wasn't until, I don't know, I'm going to fast forward here until to the year 2000. And I'd been running hard, went out to Virginia and just decided, at some point I made a conscious decision. Diane and I were talking about this yesterday. I made the conscious decision, that I was going to die. And I was going to Nebraska to die because, well, I knew some people here and I knew that I could make that happen. And I'm not even going to get into details there, but I just knew that I could be killed here in Nebraska. And so that's, I said it out loud, like, I'm going there to die. And I got here, it was in October, I got arrested on something, it was like a burglary charge or something, I forget what it was, and I bailed out immediately, and then I knew that the end was near. I just had this foreboding sense, and I knew that the end was near, so I guess, if you can call it that, got my affairs in order. You know, I made sure that my dog was taken care of, and then I went and dropped it off at my brother's place in New Mexico, and I drove back to Nebraska because I knew the end was near, and I was just, honestly, I was just tired. I mean, I was tired of hurting people. You know, every single person in my life, up to that point, I had taken something from. I had used or manipulated every single person in my life, and I was just so tired. And the only way that I knew how to cope with any of that was the emotion was anger, and the coping mechanism was drugs, and. It just so December 30th of 2000, I knew that the police were after me. It was a high speed. You know, I got into a high speed chase in the streets of Omaha in broad daylight. Went on for about 20 or 30 minutes. You know, it was a bad deal. Ended up wrecking the car. Jumped out of the car. Ran from the police. Finally, you know, they obviously. Got me, and I'm in this jail cell in Omaha, Nebraska, and I'm banging on the walls with my fist, screaming the words that I'd screamed so many times before. Why? You know, I was always the last one to figure it out. I was always the last one to realize that you know, this is where you're going to end up. And so I figured at the time that I was going to be doing life in prison because, you know, out in California they have that three strikes thing, and I already had, you know, a couple innings worth, and so I figured I was going to be doing life sentence, and that was my fate. And in walks this chaplain, Morris Jackson is his name, and he walks in, and you know, I'm fully prepared to hear the Jesus loves you speech, and I'm fully prepared with my attitude and my answers in regard to that, but he didn't bring that to me. He brought me these words that still ring in my ears. You don't have to live like this. And they're simple words, but at that time in my life, it was revelation. I was like, tell me more, because I don't want to live like this. I can't do it anymore. And he told me there was a place there in the Douglas County Jail. That's in Omaha. They called it the Life and Learning Dorm. But what it is it's, we call it the God Mod. And there's 36 guys in there, and they have volunteers that come in every day. And there's five of them that come in every day for an hour apiece, and they just preach the gospel for 5 hours a day. You're getting the gospel, and then in the in between times, they have coursework that you do in regard to, you know, going through the gospels and then going through the New Testament in its entirety, and it's like a mini Bible school inside the jail. Well, I didn't want to be a part of that because my background told me that a place like that would be for weak people only, and I wasn't one of those. And so he brought the option to me, and I said, you know, absolutely not. I won't do that because the thing of it was the cell that I was in was directly across the hall from this place, and every day about lunchtime, these guys would start singing in there. And I'm like, what in the world is going on over there? Why are they singing? And then they're all singing together, and they're singing these spiritual songs, and it would just make me more angry. Like, shut up! I don't want to hear people singing in jail.
Nothing,
you know,
to be happy about.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. That was exactly my point. Was there's nothing here to be happy about? I need you to be hopeless, just like me. Okay. And so when he brought it to me that, you know, hey, I'd like you to come check this place out, I said, oh, heck no, I'm not going there. And then about 30 minutes after he walked out the door, I submitted because, you know, here's the thing. I didn't want to live like that anymore. I didn't want to feel.
Those words really resonated, didn't they?
They really did.
They changed
really did.
Things around, got you started on a new life. That's absolutely,
you know,
amazing.
You know, he kind of left it. He kind of baited the hook, I guess. You know, and he and I we've talked many times since then. But he kind of baited the hook, and he said, "Well, you know, I'd kind of like you to go check it out, but there's really no room right now. So just, you know, submit your request, and we might be able to get you in there in about a week or two." And so I submitted my request, almost as if it weren't me doing it. Like I'm just like going through the motions, like whatever, this isn't going to happen anyway. Within, you know, an hour, I get called to go move over there. So I think it was a ruse from the get-go. I think he knew what was in store, but. Mm. So I walked into this place, and immediately there was something different. You know, there was, these guys were the guys that were singing, so there had to be something different in there. And for the next 2 weeks, I just watched and listened. I didn't do a whole lot of talking because at this point in my life, I was like the word picture I like to use is that I was a trash compactor, and I just compacted so much. That I couldn't, you know, I'd open my mouth and this emotion that I'd never dealt with would start to come out, and I'd catch it and I'd close my mouth and I just watched. But something was breaking. And, you know, at the start of this program, you talked about how out of the heart, out of the mouth is what comes out of the heart. And, that was a clear revelation to me in that time was that, you know, in this place, they didn't allow you to listen to anything but the gospel because what goes in has to come out.
You bet.
And I was so full of hate and anger and hurt and all these, you know, just self-loathing that I didn't know how to deal with that. And so that's what was starting to come out was that stuff because what I'd been putting in for the last 2 weeks at this point was the gospel, was the truth, was hope, was faith, was love, and I didn't know how to deal with any of those things. And so it was actually on the 11th day. It wasn't quite 2 weeks. It was on the 11th day. There was this guy walks in there, and one of the volunteers, and he started preaching the gospel. And I don't know the words that he used, but something broke in that moment. And I know that, like, he called to have guys come up and he wanted to pray with them, and I was the first one up there, and
wow.
that was the first time ever. And he put his hand on my chest, and he kind of said, "Whoa!" Like he sensed there was something going on in there.
He felt the anger coming out, huh?
Yeah. And I accepted Jesus Christ on that day in that moment, and I knew. I mean, the tears just came. They came for days. Like I couldn't stop. And I knew in that moment, like I had run so many times before from so many things into so many places to run again. And I had spent my whole life running. And I knew in that moment, like the running was over.
Wow.
Like I was exactly where I needed to be.
Yeah.
Because that's where I was.
Okay. Go ahead. Well, no, finish your thought.
I was just going to say, I knew that my life was never going to be the same.
Amen. Amen.
I love that.
Yeah. We're just, I'm trying to be aware of our time here because I want you to introduce your bride and get her on.
Absolutely. Hers is an interesting story, too, and I'm going to let her, Diane, it's all yours.
Hi.
Diane, hi. How are you?
Hi, Diane.
I'm doing well. I don't know if Steve told you, but I am from Minnesota as well.
They don't care.
You don't care that I'm from Minnesota?
I do.
George is pretending to care, whereas I care a lot.
George.
Hey.
I care a tremendous amount.
Bill has honesty problems.
Anyway, I'm gonna keep it brief because I can do that. I was born and raised in northern Minnesota, and I started using drugs and alcohol at a young age, about 10.
Wow.
And, yeah, youngest of 12 children, and I carried on in pretty functional dysfunction for several years until I got to be lower 30s. My life started spiraling out of control. Of course, it was, you know, not my fault. It was everything that was happening to me. And I was living in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I was involved with, well, my peers were drug users, you know, sellers, people who are involved in robberies and things like that. And, of course, if those are your peers, that's what you're doing too. So I was involved in a robbery in Lincoln, Nebraska, and about a week after I was involved in that robbery, I knew that my entrance to the prison system was coming soon. I knew it was on the horizon, but by that point I had catapulted into full-blown addiction, where, you know, previously throughout the several years of my formative years up to that point, I had managed it pretty well, to the point of, you know, I had a lot of people fooled, we'll put it that way. By the time the robbery occurred, I had been using street drugs for probably at least 3 months, almost daily, and still maintaining a full-time job and caring for two children. And I was over at my friend's house in Lincoln, and we'd been using drugs late one night, and she had her daughter and her niece was there, and my two kids were there, and they were all asleep, and we were going to go across town and use drugs. And during the time that we were gone and before we came back, her apartment had started on fire. And everyone had made it out of that fire, except for my daughter. And she ended up passing away the next day from smoke inhalation. So that, to me, was pretty much the beginning of the end. And thankfully, the day after, well, I actually took her to northern Minnesota, and we had her funeral there, and I went back to Lincoln, and we were having her memorial service there, and God knew exactly what he was doing, because I was arrested immediately after her memorial service, and that was probably the thing that saved my life, because I was either going to end up killing myself or someone else because I was so angry. And me going to prison, I mean, you know, people talk about, you know, that being a blessing in their lives, and I truly know what that means. I spent 9 months in the county jail before I went to prison, and I ended up doing 4 years in prison, but it was just enough time for God to get my attention and keep it, and help me to realize that all the choices I'd made in my life weren't just affecting me, they were affecting me, my children, my family, my friends, my community. And I realized by the time that I left that if I was going to make a real life change, I had to change everything. And that included not being around my family. Not that it was my family's fault for the choices I'd made with my life, but that I knew that if I was going to be obedient to the calling he had on my life, which was obvious at that point, that I had to do everything different. And that included listening to what he told me to do, not what my best thinking told me to do, because my best thinking got me locked up, addicted, drunk, disappointing everybody I loved, and I was miserable.
Changing everything sounds like a tall order, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But you know, it's amazing how he had it all planned out, because I was in the county jail maybe 2-3 months, and God hit me over the head with a 2x4 and told me, the minute you quit lying, I can help you. So he knew that it had to be broken down in little chunks, you know, for me, because I'm hard-headed. I'm really hard-headed. I'm from Minnesota. I have to be. So I started listening. I quit talking, and I started listening to what he wanted me to do in it. And it sure felt like the opposite of what I wanted to do, but I trusted that. I trusted that, you know, I trusted what it said in Isaiah 41:10, that told me that he would never leave me or forsake me, that he'll strengthen me and that he would help me and he'd hold me in his righteous right hand, because I didn't know what else to do. I knew there was nobody in there. At least at that point, I felt like there was nobody I could trust, and I knew I couldn't trust myself, but I figured I could trust him.
And that's a real truth, isn't it? That's probably one of the most truthful thoughts you've had in a long time, because it is true.
Right. Yeah, and I knew it was kind of weird, because before I even went to prison, I knew that I was going to do prison ministry. And I knew that I was going to come back and help the women who were walking through the same thing I'd already walked through. I knew that before I even was sentenced. But anyway, the day that God hit me over the head with the 2x4, I told my attorney that I was guilty. I said, I'm guilty of everything they're saying, and I don't know, you know, how you can help me, but it's true. Everything I said is everything they're saying is true, and whatever I, you know, get is what I get, and I'm okay with that. At that point, you know, I was going through a lot with the passing of my daughter and the guilt and the shame and the pain behind that, and not really understanding why it couldn't be me and why it was her, but God definitely had a plan. And by the time I got out of prison, it'll be 10 years ago in December. Ever since then, he's ordered my steps, and excuse me, even when it didn't make sense, I was just obedient, because I knew that my ways were wrong and his are always right. And I know that that sounds like so simple and plain, but I know that once I involve myself into the thinking process, things get messed up fast. So when I couldn't understand a lot of things, or figure out how to control things, or, you know, like why things weren't going the way I wanted to, I just kept remembering that he had a plan, and I kept thinking about the simple Bible verses that, you know, that we can all do all things through Christ who gives us strength. Because, you know, I couldn't imagine a day or even living life without drinking or getting high, because I didn't know how to cope with struggles. I didn't know how to cope with stress. I didn't know how to do life without intoxicants or things that were anti-Diane. You know, I mean, that could be anything: bad relationships, drugs, alcohol, money. But yeah, after I got out, then I knew I couldn't go home. So I went to a transitional house. And when I went to that transitional house, I realized that there was a lot of great things that were a part of that transitional house, but I knew that there was a lot of things that were missing, like a spiritual support. I mean, I'd been incarcerated for 4 years. I was waiting for somebody to tell me what time to get up and to come count me in the middle of the night. And I mean, there was a lot of things that were missing, and what it was the support that I needed. I needed to grow spiritually, and I didn't know how to do that. Going to a traditional church setting intimidated me. I felt like everybody knew, you know, who I was, and some of that may have been real, some of it may have been just my skewed thinking, but long story short, God started opening some doors for Steve and I to minister in the prison, and from the vision of a lifer in prison through a letter, it started. She wrote us a letter and told us that we needed to open a transitional house for women. And, you know, I told her, well, that was easy for her to say, because she was there and we were out here. But it's been, I believe, 5 years now, 4 or 5 years, and that's what we're doing.
Yep. You have a transitional house for females or males or both? Or
women. Just women.
Just women, okay.
Yes. Yeah. It's statistically proven that women are under-supported as they come out of incarceration or treatment. Mm-hmm.
And you can look at, in Minneapolis, Bill, just the amount of facilities that are available for men versus women. And usually with women, when we're working with them in a chemical dependency situation or coming out of prison or both, which is a lot, there's more than one person with a woman. There's usually kids here, too. And that can be a real issue for them, and they want to be a good mom, and they need the time to get sober. And I'm really glad you guys are doing that, because that is an important piece of work.
Right. So it's in the interest of time, I'm going to just keep it brief and say that we do prison ministry, we do transitional housing for women, we do community, just basic wraparound services for men and women that are coming out of prison and treatment. With Celebrate Recovery, we do that weekly here. We offer, I don't know if you've heard of Pastor Andy Stanley. I'm sure you have, but he's got all kinds of great DVD series we use to with our residents, and I'll also offer them to people in the community, and they come in and watch those, and you know, we just learn to live life on life's terms and to be obedient to His calling and whatever that is. And, you know, I'm going on, let's see, in February it'll be 14 years clean and sober, thanks to God. And, you know, the first time I went to treatment was in prison, so praise God, I don't have to go back and do it again.
Would you two consider yourselves some of the most unlikely people in the world to be doing what you're doing today from where you came from?
Yes, of course.
I just laugh when I think about it. You know, because really, if you go off percentages, I'm less than a 1% chance to be successful. Less than.
Wow. Less than 1%.
And I've been in prison 4 times, and so that alone, like after the first time, then your odds go down significantly. Then the second time, they get cut in half, so even from there. And so, you know, to be able to, it's God, man. I mean, there's the only answer to, you know, I love the name of your program. It's Real Recovery. The only real recovery comes through knowledge and a relationship of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I think the show title was my idea. I think it was.
Well, I think the whole show was your idea. I'm listening to these guys, and I'm thinking, who would be better to do what they're doing?
Because, nobody.
See, in God's,
nobody.
You know, economy, why you've got somebody, when they work with somebody, you go, God did it for me, He can do it for you. I mean, because that's the first thing we offer is hope. And there's hope in nothing else but Jesus Christ.
Right. And if listeners would like to go and look on their website, it's www.releast.com. You can go on their website and check them out and see what that website looks like. You've been absolutely fascinating guests.
Great guests.
Yeah, yeah. There has been so much to learn from your stories. You have overcome a tremendous amount, and whenever you tried to recover on your own, you seemed to put yourself back in the same place once again, even worse. It wasn't until you made the step of faith and surrendered your life to Christ were you able to have a complete change of heart and mind and lead different lives. So that is a very encouraging story. I know I've been inspired. George, just nod yes as well.
It was absolutely great.
And thank you very much for being on the program. Folks, that wraps up our episode tonight, award-winning. We'll get another award, I'm sure, Alex. Thank you very much for listening to Real Recovery. We'll hopefully see you next week. Good night, and God bless everybody.